Chapter 8. The engine casing is open, allowing smells of burnt rubber and scorched metal to waft freely. A hot, fused lump is all that remains of the light drive. The vagrant stares at it for some time. "Can you fix it?" asks Jem. The vagrant gives the engine an experimental prod. Then he hits it. Then he shakes his head.
"I knew it! I told you, didn't I? I told you that if you kept pushing the engines over their safety limits, they'd fail. I told you several times, and you didn't listen. And now we're
He notices Rila is watching him and catches himself, forcing a brighter tone.
"Now we're finding another way to get to Ferris. Any ideas?"
After a long sigh, the vagrant digs into a slot and brings out a short plastic stick. With a flick of his wrist, it telescopes out, one end unfolding to form a paddle. He hands it to Jem.
"You're kidding me. We'll never..."
The vagrant gives Jem a pointed look.
"Get there until we start."
The vagrant nods, smiles at Rila, and then snaps out a second paddle. As the two men get to work, one either side of the sea shuttle, Rila investigates. To her delight, she finds another stick in the slot. She gives it an experimental shake. Nothing happens. She tries again, more vigorous this time. Abruptly, the stick opens up, its paddle end smacking her in the face. Rila gapes at it, shocked. She blinks rapidly, taking in a shuddering breath, putting a finger to her lips. No tears come. Nodding to herself, Rila moves to the side and joins in the paddling. Hours pass, all three fixed on their work. Every so often, Jem glances over at where Delta lies on the deck. For a moment, he thinks her eyes are open, staring blankly at the sky, but when he checks again, he finds them closed. Occasionally, when his muscles are aching or when the reality of the situation strikes, he pauses to glare at the vagrant.
"Let's take a break," he finally announces, flopping back.
The vagrant raises an eyebrow, but stops paddling. While tired arms get a brief respite, the vagrant checks the nav pack. The display suggests they are veering off course. He shows it to Jem, stabbing a finger, accusing.
"What? It's not my fault. You're paddling too fast."
The vagrant rolls his eyes.
"If we're going to keep straight, you need to match my rhythm."
They try again. The strokes more synchronized. When Jem pauses to look at Delta, he falls out of time. The vagrant taps his paddle on the side of the sea shuttle.
"Sorry,"
mutters Jem, and gets back to work. Rila forgets about the paddling, focusing her attention on Jem. Every time he slows, an imperious tapping sounds, Rila prompting him to redouble his efforts and to mouth something dark. Each time, the smile on her face grows and the urge to giggle gets harder to resist. For once, the vagrant's face mirrors hers. Time passes.
"It's no good," says Jem. "I have to stop."
He points at the vagrant.
"Don't say anything. And don't give me that look either. I'm doing my best. I'm just not very good at this. If you hadn't ruined the engines, then it wouldn't be a problem, would it?"
He notices the vagrant has stopped paddling and is resting his head on his palm.
"Are you all right? You look awful."
The vagrant glances up at Jem, revealing a face lined in sweat.
"You're burning up!"
By way of confirmation, the vagrant slides from his position at the rail, flopping onto the deck. He holds up a finger, then passes out. Jem and Rila rush to his side. A quick investigation confirms a fever. Jem digs out some of the old meds from the sea shuttle and shoots them into the vagrant's arm with a med gun. He then gathers some cold water and soaks a cloth, applying it to the vagrant's forehead. Rila watches his every move, chewing nervously on her fingertips.
"Don't worry," says Jem. "He'll be fine. It's just exhaustion, I think."
Uncertainties go over her head, and she nods, content, snuggling in next to the vagrant. Jem goes to the sea shuttle's navcom. It suggests that they are close to Ferris now. He takes out the scope, checking for any breaks in the ocean, and, to his surprise, finds one. A slender tower is just visible. Thick plastic cables hang from a crown at its top, synthetic dreadlocks, uneven. Lights wink like flawed jewels along its surface. Several are missing. He takes up his paddle again, but alone he makes no headway against the waves. He tries signalling to the tower, lighting up the scope and waving it repeatedly. All the while, the sea shuttle drifts in the wrong direction. Getting desperate, Jem goes back to the medgun, loads it with a cocktail of stims and uppers, and presses it against the vagrant's thigh. He pulls the trigger. Amber eyes spring open. Soundlessly, the vagrant's mouth springs open. The vagrant is sitting up. The vagrant is standing up. The vagrant is looking around, left, right, up, down, left and right, and...
"Over there,"
says Jem, pointing to the tower. Together they paddle the sea shuttle towards it. The vagrant works like a man possessed, sometimes running to Jem's side of the sea shuttle to straighten them out. As they draw close, the cables skirting the tower begin to twitch, magnets bringing them to life. Of their own accord, they slide across the water to clonk into place on the sea shuttle's hull, gathering the small vessel in a machine's embrace. Stiffening, the cables raise it out of the water until it's level with a hatch in the tower's side. Next to the hatch is a circular plate of darkened plasglass. Tiny green LEDs play across it, sparkling. The vagrant moves up to the hatch and looks into the panel. Light maps his face, highlighting scars. There is a pause, then a buzz of rejection. Jumping back onto deck, the vagrant picks up Delta's sword. It just has time to open its eye in surprise before the vagrant leaps over to the hatch again, pressing the crosspiece against the panel. There is a muted hum of alarm from the blade, followed by a resonant ping of acceptance. The hatch swings open. With a grin, wild, the vagrant turns back to the others. He holds up a hand to them and then steps into the hatch.
"Hold on," says Jem. "I think we should stay together."
He moves to the vagrant's side and adds in a lower voice,
"I don't feel safe with Delta here."
They both look at Delta and nod. As they're about to leave, Rila holds up a hand. Bemused, they watch her cover Delta with the vagrant's old coat, tucking it in around silver shoulders. The vagrant nods four times in approval, excess energy shifting him from foot to foot.
"Ah, how are you doing?"
asks Jem. The vagrant gives him a thumbs up and plunges through the open hatch. A moment later, a smaller thumb is also raised as Rila runs after him. Jem pauses to mutter something under his breath before following. As they enter, lights come on inside the tower, blink off, stutter a few times, then stabilize, casting the space in harsh white light. The room is circular, empty, with featureless walls and a studded metal floor. Behind them, the hatch swings shut, its seal sucking into place. They all jump.
"Now what?"
asks Jem. Rila and the vagrant shrug. They don't hear any movement, but they feel it in their bellies, a sudden lessening of gravity as the room begins to fall. Rila holds out her arms. Jem steadies himself against the wall, and the vagrant crouches down, fingers resting lightly on the floor for balance. There is an ugly screeching sound, and the room shakes, slows, then resumes its progress. Down it goes, into the depths. Like an iceberg, only the tip of Ferris is visible above the surface, most of its bulk spread across and under the seabed. Stomachs return to their normal positions, and on the opposite side of the room from where they came in, a new hatch opens. Any lights that once worked in this part of the station failed long ago. Jem switches the scope to torch mode and shines it nervously into the corridor. The beam of light shakes as it describes the way ahead. A ridged tube stretches before them, the opaque surface mottled with shadows. A few of them move, suggesting life of a sort on the outside. Fixing his gaze firmly at his feet, the vagrant sets off, holding Rila's hand in one of his, Delta's sword in the other. Jem keeps close, twitching every time something moves beyond the curved walls. At the other end is another hatch. This, too, opens for them. In the darkness revealed on the other side, something screams. At the sight of it, Jem screams, too. Delta of the Seven remains where she was placed on the deck of the sea shuttle. The sound of Alpha's song, far away, carries on essence currents. Eyes of storm cloud grey open. Motionless, she stares up, listening, understanding, reflecting, and tears of stone slide down the sides of her face. The Knight Commander straightens at the incoming call, and on the bridge of resolution, officers pause in their work, sensing the incoming change. Obeisance's smooth features project in the air before him, and her voice is fed like a balm into his ear. Knight Commander, I trust you are well.
I am, and ready to serve.
As are we all. I have resumed my place at the Seven's side, and they have spoken. Prepare yourself, old friend. There is much work to do, and the Seven are keen to hunt down the traitors.
The Knight Commander braces himself.
I am sorry to report that the quarry has eluded us. We believe the first and the bearer have separated from the other ships, but we're unclear as to where either is going.
You are mistaken. Our lenses in the south have already told us their destination. You are to make your way there with all haste, stopping en route only to purge the locations I am sending you to.
Her face is replaced with maps full of blinking lights. The Knight Commander responds,
It would be most efficient if I split the fleet, dividing the targets between them.
Proceed as you see fit. We trust you to make the right decision.
You honor me.
Her face reappears. Even across a link, he finds her scrutiny wearing.
There is one other thing. Assemble a squad of your most experienced troops and dispatch them to Ferris at once. Consider them at my disposal. It is unlikely they will return.
Understood.
Pick only those whose faith is unshakable.
Understood.
But he does not truly understand. Surely all of them have unshakable faith. Why say that unless there was reason to doubt, or perhaps she has reason to doubt his people, or doubt him?
Unpleasant thoughts about Abeason swim to the surface of his mind. Unworthy but insistent, they plant a seed of doubt that forms quick roots. None of it shows on his face.
Good. We will rendezvous with you on the coast. May the winged eye watch over you.
And also over you,
he intones. Cutting the link, he addresses his officers. Minutes later, the armada splits into four fleets and a skyship peels off, its passengers loaded with secret purpose. Trembling torchlight sketches features. A half-breed, nearly as wide as it is tall. Skin so pale the veins look like wounds. Even internal organs are visible as watery impressions. Rolls of rubbery fat strip the figure of sex, tufts of hair sprouting in all the wrong places and none of the right ones. A thin membrane covers the space between lips and ears, the nostrils reduced to two shades in the skin. Thick arms end in fat fingers, webs of flesh hanging between them. They are pressed in horror against its face as it screams. Jem screams back, prompting it to scream again, prompting Jem to scream again, a game passing back and forth until the vagrant holds up a hand, firm. Jem stops. A scream later, the other stops too. The vagrant looks at Jem, gestures towards the half-breed. He takes the hint, clearing his throat.
Hello? We're not here to fight. My name is Jem. Do you understand me?
There is a pause, then a grunt.
I said, do you understand?
Another pause. Jem looks for support, but the vagrant repeats his previous gesture.
Hello, he says slowly. I'm Jem.
He points to himself for emphasis, then repeats.
Jem, we are hungry.
He rubs his tummy a few times.
Hungry. Understand?
Cautiously, the half-breed approaches Jem. The vagrant steps out of the way. Rila does the same. Jem flinches as the fat, webby fingers reach out, moist where they touch him, like being rubbed with wet jelly.
What are you...
It stretches the membrane of its mouth wide, then snatches the torch out of Jem's hands.
Hey!
Prize in fist, it turns away to lope off down the corridor. Jem says to the vagrant, spreading his hands.
That wasn't my fault.
The vagrant sets off in pursuit, pulling Rila with him.
It wasn't,
he mutters, hurrying after, before the light leaves him behind. Torchlight shows slivers of rooms, suggestions of the overall state of Ferris. Something of the sea has found its way inside. Spores nestle in corners, glowing softly in the damp air. Crates lie scattered on their sides, contents spilling out and abandoned. The sound of a pump can be heard, working, rhythmic, getting louder. Boots begin to splash as they step, seawater sneaking in through a tiny crack that is never fixed, then pumped out only to sneak back again, a stalemate. The half-breed leads them deep within the station until they reach a heavy-looking door, hexagonal, lined in pulsing neon. With a hiss, the door opens, revealing a small room. The walls and floor are blank. No exits. Nothing of note. The half-breed jumps straight in.
"Do you think it's another lift?"
asks Jem. The vagrant doesn't answer, stepping inside with Rila. When Jem has joined them, the door closes. Seconds pass, and the walls lose their density, going from dark grey to light to transparent. Revealed on the other side are rows of cylindrical tanks. There are 15 in all. 4 are broken and dark. The remaining 11 are filled with a pale yellow liquid, and 3 of them contain bodies. These last 3 glide forward on hidden means of locomotion until they press against the glass, the faces within magnified and distorted. A man and woman with old, wrinkly skin, and another man, younger, almost as wrinkled. From a speaker somewhere, a simple tune plays, and the half-breed flops down. The tune repeats, and the half-breed's head lolls forward. A third repetition, and it is asleep. Jem bends down and picks up the torch. The speaker crackles, and then a voice can be heard, matching the movements of the older man's mouth.
Apologies for the lack of a proper welcome, but as you can see, we have some difficulties here. I hope Giblet didn't cause you any troubles. He's well-meaning, but he gets overexcited sometimes.
Jem points to the sleeping half-breed.
That's Giblet?
Yes. When they're born, they look like giblets. He can't talk much yet, but he understands a lot. Not bad for a 12-month-old.
The vagrant and Jem exchange a look, and the speaker distorts with laughter.
Oh, I know. Imagine what we said when we first found out. I'm sure you're full of questions. Actually, we have a few of our own. I hope you don't mind, but we will expect you to answer them all.
Before that, Jem replies, is there any chance of something to eat? We've come a long way, and...
The speaker snaps off, but it is clear that the man is still talking. The other two tanked figures interject occasionally, the fluid wisping around them, making expressions and lips hard to read. A minute passes while the vagrant twitches with unused energy. Reela yawns. Giblet begins to snore, the air catching some loose flap of skin inside his throat, making wet vibrations. The three figures turn towards them again, and, with a slight pop, the man's voice returns.
Yes, this will suit us all. Giblet will bring you food, and you can eat and rest while we discuss our position on your arrival amongst ourselves.
Your position? Asks Jem. Is there a problem?
Problem? No, not a problem. Not even close to a problem. Nothing to worry about. Just some little kinks to straighten before we decide what to do with you.
As the walls darken, removing him from sight, the man in the cylinder puts a hand to his mouth, his expression that of a naughty child caught with a hand in the sweet jar. A simple tune plays, and Giblet jerks awake.
Feed our guests,
comes the man's voice.
Use only the special stock. Feed them, Giblet. Only from the special stock. Feed them well.
Giblet is gone for some time. When he returns, he is carrying a bulging plastic sack under one arm and a tube with a nozzle under the other. When the sack is put down, there is an audible squelch. With practiced ease, Giblet fastens the other end of the tube to a valve on the top of the sack and then offers the nozzle.
After you, Jem murmurs.
The vagrant takes the nozzle and lifts it up to the eye in Delta's sword. It opens, obliging, and stares into the nozzle. It looks up at the vagrant, indifferent, then closes again. Satisfied, the vagrant puts the nozzle to his mouth, and Giblet gives the bag a squeeze. A thick gel eases from the end, the yellow hue remarkably similar to the liquid inside the tanks. Giblet waits for a curly pile to collect on the vagrant's tongue before releasing the sack. The vagrant closes his mouth. He looks up at the ceiling as if searching for something, then swallows.
"Well?"
asks Jem, holding Reela back as she reaches for the nozzle. The vagrant raises a thumb.
"Really?"
The vagrant nods, and Jem lets Reela past. Giblet squeezes the bag for her, and then Jem has a turn.
It's really good.
Reela is already reaching for the nozzle again. They take turns, uneven, stuffing as much of the nameless substance into their mouths on each rotation until the sack is empty and three bellies stretch happily to capacity. When they are done, Giblet takes the sack away, the large door opening just long enough for him to leave. Soon they are all sat against the wall. Jem looks at the vagrant.
"I hope we don't come to regret eating that."
The vagrant yawns. Reela yawns.
"I suppose we didn't have much of a choice."
Reela starts to flop over, but the vagrant catches her and leans her against his side. Jem clutches at his stomach in panic.
"Do you think it was drugged?"
The vagrant frowns, then shakes his head.
"But how can you be sure?"
He fights the sudden urge to yawn.
"I don't like it here. At least one of us should stay awake."
The vagrant nods slowly.
"I think it should be you."
A smile twitches at the corner of the vagrant's mouth. Then amber eyes close.
"I hate you,"
whispers Jem. He holds the scope close, taking comfort from its light. He cannot be sure, but it seems as if the walls are losing their colour. Not completely transparent, but different somehow. Another yawn threatens, is stifled. He thinks about the stims he injected into the vagrant, wonders if they have lost effectiveness due to age or whether they have been neutralized by other, stronger medication. The next yawn gets past his guard. The one after that overcomes him completely. 1046 years ago. Masasi wakes with a start. She is sitting in her control chair, a comfortable enough design, but hardly built for sleep. How long has she been dozing? She looks at the globe of screens all around her, each one monitoring a different corner of her vast empire. Even so, there are not enough to show every relevant feed, and so the images flicker, moving to whatever seems most important, the globe revolving to bring the newest developments to eye level. It has been a long time since she sat here. Too long. Her senses are no longer attuned to the screens in the way they were, and ocular fitness has gone. Masasi tuts at herself. She is losing her edge. And that should be fine. Alpha should have more than enough edge to carry them all, and Beta should be enough to stop it cutting too deep. She is confident in her new creations, but not confident enough to rest. After a time of recovery, she has come to check on their progress, to make sure that they are getting things right. So far, the numbers are not quite what she was hoping for. Certainly, there have been fewer deaths since Beta joined his brother. Indeed, the Empire is functional, stable. It is not getting worse, but neither is it getting better. There seems to be something missing. Masasi cannot put her finger on why, but her creations lack spark and innovation. It also bothers her that they are both cast in male forms. Should she not leave something closer to her own image behind as well? An uncommon sensation runs through her at the thought, that of doubt. She is aware that it has taken longer to recover from Beta's making than it did for Alpha's. She is getting weaker. With each new creation, there is less of her own essence to draw upon. Nonetheless, once she has had the idea of making something new, it will not leave her. It nags her as she endures her daily treatments, bothers her as she attends to the latest overview reports from Piece 15, and forbids her from getting any meaningful sleep. The next day, less than 24 hours later, she is standing in her workshop, weary limbs supported by a slender exoskeleton, Beta to her left and Alpha to her right. She senses their excitement and curiosity. It mirrors her own. They do not ask what she is doing, and she does not explain. They love her without question. It is far more than mortal love, for Alpha and Beta have powers like hers, and their emotions are tangible things that change the world around them. Their loving attention is a force so powerful that Masasi feels her aches lighten. Without preamble, she commences her next great work. With Alpha, she sought perfection. With Beta, she tried to capture wisdom and practicality. Now she tries for something less defined, the desire to strive for more, a replica of her will. A female form takes shape under her hammer. Broad-shouldered and winged like her brothers, but curving differently at the chest and hips. The face is modelled after her own, though even Masasi admits that this is an artist's rendition, flattering, based on a nostalgic memory of younger features. She gives the body a sword to match Alpha's, and then stops. There is a nagging feeling of something not being quite right, and she is too tired to identify it. It can wait until tomorrow. Alpha and Beta walk beside her, patient, as she shuffles back to her bed. The next day finds Masasi just as tired, her body sluggish, her mood black. Fresh eyes find nothing wrong with the previous day's work. In fact, she is pleased. She asks Alpha and Beta for their opinion, and both agree it is flawless. Of course, to them, everything Masasi does is flawless. They are incapable of seeing otherwise. Satisfied that all is ready, and resigned to the fact that she is not going to feel any better no matter how long she waits, Masasi raises her metal arm. Alpha and Beta lift the platform that she stands on, bringing her within easy reach of the statue's silver head. The iris in Masasi's palm opens, and she presses it to the inert face. The plan is to imbue the creation with drive and ambition, a lack of satisfaction that will not allow rest or slothfulness. But as the essence begins to flow, she finds other feelings taking over. Unbidden, thoughts of her life float to the surface, of the way she was used as a child, worked hard without care for her safety or sanity. This world she works to save is a bitter one, an ungrateful one, and she is angry, so, so angry. That rage courses through her new creation, flooding through the sword to the body and back, like a river bursting the walls of a dam. Masasi cannot stop it, her essence seeming to move with a will of its own, filling the shell to the brim until it radiates such heat that the air shimmers and bends. Three eyes open, sudden, and Masasi is repulsed by what she sees, stumbling back into Alpha's ready arms. It is like looking at a younger, perfect version of herself, and it is too painful. Gamma's eyes are sky blue like Alpha's, but hers are colder, a mirror of Masasi's disapproval. Where Alpha and Beta's love is bolstering, Gamma's stare is like a stab in the face, a voice shouting that she should have done better. She turns her head away, letting it rest on Alpha's chest, and instantly regrets it, knowing the gesture to be weak, and knowing that Gamma will see it. The trouble is, she feels weak, weak and empty. Rage has driven her through years of adversity, and now it has gone into Gamma, leaving only a faint shadow behind. That is what she is becoming, she realizes. A shadow. A watermark where once there was an ocean. "This," she croaks, "is your sister, Gamma." At the sound of her name, Gamma steps forward, bending down so that her lips can move close to Masasi's ear.
"Get up, Creator,"
she says, her voice as hard as the blade she carries.
"There is more to do."